just being in a team makes you work that extra bit harder and you have a role to play.
All the six girls are 100% committed on what they have to do.
We race with hearts and you have your goals, and if you're racing, you're racing.
You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina with Ola Chenery and Richard Knorr, supported by Rowan King Cycling Coaching.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Orla Chenery.
Good afternoon, Richard.
Hello, Orla.
Hi.
This is a historic first ever cycling podcast Femina.
It is indeed. We feel the weight of history on our shoulders.
Weeks in the planning.
Months, shall
Months
we say.
Months in the planning. Years, even.
Let's not go that far.
We're all ready to go. We've got lots of material for this first episode. It's going to be a monthly show, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Lots of exciting plans.
Yeah, a great first episode coming up, even if I do say so myself. We've got an interview with Lizzie Armitstead, the world champion. We've got a feature on her Bowles Dolmans team, who've just been absolutely dominant this season. Got a chat with Guy Elliott as well, who says some quite strong things, really, about the Aviva Women's Tour and how that came about. And we've also got a little feature on the Drop cycling team, which you did.
We've got the Drop cycling team, a young team in the UK. A great story behind that. We've also got Lionel Burney's retro feature. Lionel, my colleague from the cycling podcast. Lionel and Daniel will both be involved in the cycling podcast Femina. But a little bit about the name, where our name comes from Lionel. And he'll probably do a retro feature each month.
He likes his retro.
He's a man who likes to look backwards rather than forwards.
We're the forward-looking part of the podcast,
exactly.
Then, into the future.
Exactly. But we're all set to go, Orla. We've had a few of your energy balls, Orla's famous energy balls here.
Yes,
at, they are. At Chenoway Towers.
Chenoway Towers.
South London.
They fuel me on a daily basis. They sound a bit suspect. They're not really, but they are amazing. I've had six today. You sampled one. What did you think?
Very nice, delicious, very datey.
Very datey, yes.
There's some seeds in there as well.
Yeah. All good stuff.
Are available on the market?
No, but I could maybe bring them to races if you'd like to purchase one or two from me at a discounted rate, of course. They're homemade. I make them.
I can see that. we also will be announcing our first ever Pedaleuse de Charme. We obviously do Pedaleur de Charme in our regular podcast. We'll be doing Pedaleuse de Charme. Should say that this is not instead of women's coverage on the regular podcast. We will still cover women's cycling a bit on the regular podcast that we do, which is weekly. But this is additional, and we felt the time was right to launch a podcast focused solely on women's cycling. And it will be very much focused on the riders and the racing. The issues will be dealt with, but the focus will be predominantly on the riders and the racing. And a few catalysts for that, I suppose. There's a real momentum behind women's racing. We did an interview with Lizzie Armitstead in late February, which had a tremendous response. I mean, she's a very interesting, articulate athlete with a great story. But it had an amazing response, an amazing sort of over 100,000 people listened to that. So we felt the appetite is there, the time is right, let's do it.
Yeah, and we were talking about this a moment ago as well, the recent incident with Shea and Sutton and the whole furore surrounding whether or not sexism was rife in British cycling. And as you quite rightly said, Richard, there was so much coverage given to the question of sexism, and that coverage could have been given over to women's cycling. And I think that we're keen to highlight the issue. I say we in inverted commas. I think we as a collective are keen to highlight the issue of sexism, but why not spend our energy actually talking about women's racing instead?
The cycling podcast Femina, interviews, insight and analysis of women's racing. Supported by Rowan King Cycling Coaching, tailored training plans by Danny King and Luke Rowe. For more information, go to rowanking.com.
Thank you very much to Rowe and King, who are sponsoring the cycling podcast Femina for our first three episodes. That'll take us up to August. Rowe and King is, of course, Luke Rowe of Team Sky and Danny King of Wiggle High Five, who teamed up a year or so ago to set up this training company. Anyone can sign up, and I think it involves a monthly phone call from either Luke Rowe or Danny King.
Yeah, one of the four packages I think there are involves a phone call every month from Luke or Danny, which would be quite intimidating, I think, if you haven't done your daily sessions. You're going to get a right ticking off.
You'll find out, Orla, when you sign up. I think that's part of the. Part of the deal. We'll have an interview with Danny King in next month's podcast. She can tell us a little bit more about that, about her own career as well. Of course, she should be finding out imminently whether she's going to Rio as part of the Olympic team. We'll no doubt be talking about that as well. Anyway, let's crack on. We've got a package on Bowles Dolmans, haven't we, Orla?
Yeah, we do indeed. As you know, the first ever UCI Women's World Tour Series kicked off in early March. Lizzie Armitstead winning Strade Bianche to kick that off. And she set the tone as her Bowles Dolmans team have dominated the series. Chantal Black won Ronde van Drenthe and Gent Wevelgem. And Armitstead then again won the Trofeo Alfredo Binda and the Tour of Flanders. It wasn't until late April that another team even had a look in, with Anna van der Breggen of Raboliv winning Flèche Wallonne. Well, Chloe Hosking of Wiggle High Five won the Tour of Chongming Island, but in the last two World Tour races, Bowles Dolmans have been back on top. With Armitstead taking a break from racing, Megan Garnier won the Tour of California and the Philadelphia International Cycling Classic. Now, that means that of the nine events so far, Bowles Dolmans have won no fewer than seven. So, do they just have better riders? Are they better organised? And what does Bowles Dolmans' domination say about the other teams? Well, to try and find out some answers to those questions, we sent reporter Owen Rogers to Flèche Wallonne. He spoke to the Bowles Dolmans riders and their director, Danny Stamm. But first he spoke to a rider on a rival team, Emma Johansson of Wiggle High Five, who was second to Armitstead at the Tour of Flanders.
Emma Johansson, Swedish road and time trial champion, racing for Wiggle High Five. I didn't expect Bulls to be so good, and the way they have been racing until maybe a couple of weeks back, like, they had just been outstanding. But the season is long and it's not going to last. Or I hope it's not going to last. The goal is that it's not going to last.
What has been the secret to their success?
I think just early form in general in the team. Like, everyone came super strong into the first races, and once they started winning, it was like they had nothing to lose anymore. So then you can dare to gamble maybe a little bit more. They've been there with more or less five or six riders in the finals at every race. And of course, if you have a lot of cards to play, then it makes it really difficult for the rest. So I think that it makes tactics easy.
Well, Johansson has plenty of cards to play herself, and she gave us her early impression on the Women's World Tour and whether it's made any real difference.
Well, I've had a really good season so far, and I've just been in good form, and the team has been performing really well, especially lately. But when it comes to the World Tour, I think it's so far it feels like it's been more or less the World Cup races from last year. I love the fact that they've done a World Tour and that it's all this and everything is in it, both stage races and the single day races and all that. But I also, I can't see, maybe towards the end of the season you might think, oh, actually I'm up there, you know. Yeah. Last year it was, you had riders who could go for the GC in the World Cup. The individual races are very important. It's going to be super important at every start, but we're also going to have different team compositions for every single race that we do in the World Tour. But in the end, we race with hearts, and you have your goals, and if you're racing, you're racing. And I'm old-fashioned.
Evie Stevens with Bowles Dolmans and current hour record holder. Bowles Dolmans has been incredible this season, just keeps winning and winning, and I think, you know, just because there's so much depth on the team and we ride as a unit. Cycling, when you turn on TV, it looks like it's an individual sport, but really it's a team sport. And I think because we have so much strength and that so many potential winners, if you ride in support of one another, it allows for us to, you know, cross the line first. I mean, everyone in the peloton all have that strength. I think it's respect, it's professionalism, it's mental, it's the way you approach it. So yeah, I mean, there's obviously the physical capabilities, and we're all super professional, we train really hard, this is our lives. I mean, just like a professional male athlete, we are exactly the same except for women. For me, this is my job, so if I'm going to help someone, that's what I do, that's what I get paid for. Bike racing is very dynamic and fluid, and you have to be intelligent and think on the road and communicate on the road, which I think the team is really good at. Also, this team is amazing at positioning themselves in the peloton. So anytime you see a bike race, you always see them in the front riding together. I think that's one of their strengths.
Well, Megan Garnier has been the woman in form in recent weeks, winning the last two World Tour events in America, consolidating her lead at the top of the Women's World Tour.
My entire career has been a progression. So each year I look to be better than the previous year. But I also think that Danny Stam, the manager, and all of my teammates, they see things in you that you might not believe in of yourself. Mm-hmm. And they make you believe it by pushing you to do it. And you do it. And I feel like I question myself more than I question my teammates. I think sometimes you're your own toughest critic. And I work hard. I put in the hours. I put in the effort. And I see myself as one thing. But when they're the ones riding next to you and actually seeing you, you're like, well, if they're actually seeing this and telling me this, then it must be true. Because actually, our team is not very good at they're not very good fibbers.
Well, they tell it like it is.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Oh, okay. Do you think that's part of it though? Is it honesty?
Oh, for sure, honesty. And yeah, you know when you've done well and you know mm-hmm. when you've done poorly. And yeah, I mean, sometimes it's hard to hear criticism, but I think that's part of being a professional is taking that and using it to your advantage and making yourself a stronger rider, making yourself a smarter rider, making yourself a better teammate. And that's all playing into being the best in the world. What we have is not something that was built at a team building camp. Like, we didn't go do a ropes course or anything. It's something that happens around the dinner table. Mm-hmm. It happens at the breakfast table when you're just waking up, talking to each other. It's been very natural within this team.
Sitting in the Bols Dolmans team car is Danny Stam, a Dutch former six-day rider who's managed the women's team since 2013.
Well, I think the key to their success is that the team works longer than 1 year together and that the girls know each other. I mean, it's all individual super athletes, and if we can get them exactly how we want them to work together and the trust, we give them the trust that they need, yeah, then you get a big success. For example, it's more a friendships team as well. If you see yesterday, we had a birthday from Carol, and if you see how they do that and how they give the presents and how happy everybody about that part is, then you really see that it's a friendship team. And I think that is something what you not can build in 1 year, that have to grow. And if you pick the good persons together, yeah, then you will get a team what you have now. I think I have stars enough in my team. What I really appreciate is that the balance is good in the team. On the end of the rit, there's just one girl who can win Flanders. And it's not possible to win with four girls Flanders on the same race.
So we heard there, Orla, from various characters on the Bols Dolmans team. And as we were listening to that, you made an observation that there were similarities, parallels with HTC High Road, Mark Cavendish's old team, which had this sort of alchemy, this chemistry.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It feels like the glory days of HTC High Road, HTC Columbia, when they were just winning and no one could really put their finger on why. And when one team is a winning way, you from the outside, you ask, well, what is it that they're doing right? From the inside, they say, well, we're just doing everything right. We're just working incredibly hard. We're being more professional than everyone else. But sometimes it is something more intangible on top of all of that, which is success, breeding more confidence, breeding more success. And things just tend to gel incredibly well. And I think with these teams, as with HTC High Road, it's only afterwards that you look back and are able to identify what it was that made that team so great. But certainly I think at the moment, Bols Dolmans are going through one of these golden periods whereby they just seem to have it. And what that it is, probably they don't even know, but it's fantastic to watch.
Well, Emma Johansson made the point as well that when teams are winning, they are more likely to carry on winning. There's less fear. There's more willingness to take risks, the kind of risks that often pay off, you know. And you see that with teams that haven't won find it really difficult to win. They make bad choices and things like that. The pressure begins to tell. And I think also, I can't remember whether it was actually Megan Garnier or Evie Stevens who said about Lizzie Armstead being somebody who is the best female rider in the world at the moment and who other riders are kind of scared of. And, you know, I think her hitting the ground running, so to speak, at Het Nieuwsblad in late February, which weirdly wasn't a World Tour event, which is slightly odd, but the way that she rode and won that race and then started Bianchi both times on her own and then also on the Tour of Flanders, you know, to have your talismanwoman performing like that and winning, that is obviously a huge factor as well, I think.
Yeah, and that fear factor, fear is the crucial word there, I think, is so important because psychology plays such an important part of racing. And if you can scare the other teams into wondering how on earth they're going to be able to beat you, then generally they can't. I mean, if you look back to before Lizzie Armitstead was as dominant as she is now, looking back to the London 2012 Olympics when Marianne Vos took the gold medal, and it was herself and Lizzie Armitstead pretty much right to the line. But afterwards, Armitstead said that she just didn't have the confidence to be able to push herself any further, but physically she could have done it, but that in her head she was, I guess, happy to settle for silver against someone as imperious as Marianne Vos. And that sort of changed now. So now Armitstead is the one that other people fear and maybe just don't have the confidence that they can beat. And as long as that keeps continuing, then Armitstead will keep winning races.
She has the aura. There is a point as well, which we'll return to in the last part of this podcast, about, you know, what it was a question you raised at the start of that, what it says about the other women's teams. And I think, you know, they made the point, a few of them, that they're very professional. And there is a question about how many other teams are professional. And one of the things I think we want to do in this podcast is really go a bit beyond racing, because for a lot of women racing at a very high level, that's not all they do. You know, and even at the World Tour level, there are teams there which are essentially amateur. And there's a huge kind of spectrum of abilities and, you know, opportunity as well. We should hear from Lizzie Armitstead as well, the team leader, world champion. She's done something very interesting. She's not raced at all in May. She took the month off, you know, and it was quite an important month for racing. And when I spoke to her about that recently, she said that it was a bit of a battle with the sponsors, who obviously wanted her to carry on racing. But she sacrificed May for her Olympic ambitions. Mm-hmm. She's divided the season into two. First part was all about winning these races in the way that she does, generally using her sprint, although she only actually needed that at the Tour of Flanders, didn't she, to beat Johansson. But she's sort of trying to convert herself into more of a climber. So she spent the month at home in Monaco just training on her own and working a lot on the climbs to try and develop the sort of climbing ability that might help her win a gold medal at the Olympic road race in Rio. But we spoke to Lizzie also about the dominance of her team, Bols Dolmans, and much else besides. Here she is.
Spring was really good. I was really pleased with the way it went. I was hoping to be able to peak in Flanders and tick off a career goal, but I've ticked off a couple along the way. Danny Stam has put together a group of women who are all different characters, but it works really well, and we have a balance in the team. Obviously, we have good climbers, we have good sprinters, and we have a lot of different goals to manage, but somehow we're coping, and everybody has found their place in the team and gets supported when it's their day and their event, and just a real strong bond I think we have. It comes down to honesty. So at the start of the season, we sit round together and we discuss who wants to be good where and who wants what goals, right? It was very clear to the team that I wanted to win in Flanders, and that was a difficult discussion the week before, because everybody actually wants to win Flanders, but it's about stating your cause on the way into that race. And I think the form that I had going into it, I had to be the undisputed leader, and the team got behind me, and like I did for Megan and Evie going into Flèche Wallonne, I recognised that their chances were better than mine, and committed to them. We're always asked what our secret is, and our secret is really just working hard. There's no shortcuts. And I think we are probably one of the most professional teams. We're looked after very well. We have fantastic sponsors. Specialised being on board is huge for us. We have the best equipment, I think, in the women's peloton. And it's about justifying that and being professional and working hard and justifying the input from our sponsors. It's been hard. It's been challenging. There's a lot of expectation. There's a lot of media, a lot more than I've ever had to deal with before. And that's quite tiring. But the best thing for me is when I get to race, because I'm always talking about being world champion and I'm always talking about what I want to do. And then when I actually get my helmet on and get in the race, I'm like, finally, this is what I'm doing it for. This is what it's all about. So I love the bike riding part. I love racing in it, yeah. It's every cyclist's dream, the rainbow jersey. It's iconic. I don't think it transcends across sport in general. Like, explaining to people the difference between the Olympics and world titles, the importance of them. Being an Olympic champion is massive in sport. Yeah. Everyone understands it, but true cyclists, cycling fans, appreciate the rainbow jersey more, I think. It's something that I've always dreamed of wearing. Obviously, I'd prefer to wear the rainbow jersey, yeah. I've worked very hard for that, and it represents an incredible amount of work. And the World Tour jersey is something different. It's more of a kind of a marketing thing for the Women's World Tour. It's not something I've ever dreamt of wearing, so I think it's best to kind of err on the side of positivity with this one. The Women's World Tour has got sort of a manifesto surrounding it to try and improve the women's sport, and if the jersey represents that, then that's a good thing, but it doesn't mean that I have to dream of winning it. I'm able to choose my race program going into it, which I think is so valuable. Not everybody gets to do that. And yeah, they're understanding in my sponsorship commitments, and I've got the best equipment, and I just feel, I feel like I'm in the absolutely the best team possible to prepare me for Rio. Oh, it's part of the job. I mean, I do that every year at the World Championships. So, I mean, to be Olympic champion, you have to be pretty selfish and self-focused.
The cycling podcast Féminin's name is inspired by the Tour de France Féminin that was held alongside the men's Tour de France from 1984 to 1989. But did you know that the first Tour de France Féminin was held in 1955? It was organised by Jean Luliot, who ran Paris-Nice for many years, and the idea of women's racing at that time ruffled feathers among the French cycling establishment. Nevertheless, the five-day race in Normandy went ahead, and it was won by a British rider, Millie Robinson, perhaps the original Manx missile, because she lived most of her life on the Isle of Man. Anyway, Robinson and her British teammate June Thackeray were first and second, and in 1984, the same year that the women's road race was admitted to the Olympic Games, the Tour Féminin was actually part of the Tour de France organisation. Each day, the women's race passed by and arrived at the finish just before the publicity caravan, using the same finish line as the men's race. All but one of the 18 stages was held over the closing parts of the men's stages on the same roads. The longest was just 78 kilometres, and they tended to be around 60 to 70 kilometres, which meant that the women's tour had a lot of long transfers and five rest days. But the peloton of 36 riders representing six national teams did have 18 days of racing, covering 1,000 kilometres, around about a quarter of the length of the men's tour that year. The men's prize money, though, was almost 15 times greater than that was available for the women. Most of the stages finished in bunch sprints, which is probably why 35 of the 36 riders made it to Paris. The one retiree broke her collarbone in a crash, and the race itself was dominated by a very strong Dutch team. Between them, Mieke Havik, Petra de Bruin, Helene Hager, Connie Meyer, Henneke Lievers won 15 of the 18 stages, with Havik's tally of 5 giving her the points competition prize and green jersey. But the overall, the yellow jersey, was won by an American, Marianne Martin, who won the two most difficult stages to Grenoble and La Plagne in the Alps, to beat Holland's Helen Hager by 3 minutes 17 overall. Another American, Deborah Shumway, was a distant third, and the best British rider was Claire Greenwood in 7th. But the best riders in the world were not at this Tour Féminin in 1984. The Soviets, the best Americans, including Connie Carpenter, who won the road race at the Los Angeles Games later that summer, and Jenny Longo were training for the Olympics in Colorado. Despite that, Mariana Martin, a 26-year-old from Boulder in Colorado, was a worthy winner, although as she told Richard for a chapter of the cycling anthology, the women's race had not just a low-key reception, but a mixed one. Jacques Anquetil, who was then the only five-time Tour de France winner, wrote in L'Equipe, "I have absolutely nothing against women's sports, but cycling is much too difficult for a woman. They are not made for the sport. I prefer to see a woman in a short white skirt, not racing shorts. I'm sorry to see women suffer. On a bicycle, there's always a lot of suffering." Dr. Gerard Nicolet, the women's tour doctor, countered that by saying, "Women are capable of racing the complete Tour de France, although not as fast as the men. 90% of the medical problems we've had so far are unisex, tendonitis, overfatigue, falls, that sort of thing. In fact, of the 36 women who entered, 35 are still here, which I think shows that the women can do it." So that was the first of the Tour Féminin, which ran until 1989, and in future episodes we'll be recapping a few of the other races and stars and looking at other historical stories from the past of women's cycling. Additional information for this segment came from Winning Bicycle Racing Illustrated, French Cycling, A Social and Cultural History by Hugh Dauncey, and The Washington Post.
So we heard there from Lionel Burney with his monthly retro feature.
I'm looking forward to those.
And that explains a little bit about the name that we've adopted. It harks back to the early editions of the Tour de France Féminin, which ran and, you know, for a while threatened to become a major event. It seemed always hugely important that the women's winners stood on the podium in Paris with the men's winners. And I wrote a chapter for the cycling anthology, which Lionel mentioned there, about that first women's Tour de France Féminin, mm-hmm. in 1984. It was won by a woman called Marianne Martin, American, who I tracked down. She lives in Boulder in Colorado. She's a portrait photographer now. And a very unassuming woman who was quite puzzled and perplexed to be tracked down by a journalist.
Really, was she?
Well, it just showed how, you know, it didn't really register, although there are these pictures of her standing on the podium with Laurent Fignon, Greg LeMond and Bernard Hinault. It was a race that was run over much shorter stages, so the transfers, they would ride the last 60 to 80 kilometres of each of the men's stages, and the transfers were long, but she didn't complain about anything. I mean, she had to pay her own way to New York, and then her expenses were taken care of. And she went, and she was a fantastic climber. It was a small field, like 36 riders. Mm-hmm. It didn't make much of an impact. The fact that it existed at all owed an awful lot to Felix Levitin, who was, we'll hear from Guy Elliott later on, but he was like an early Guy Elliott. Mm-hmm. He was the real pioneer, and he looked on, a bit like Guy Elliott with the women's tour in Britain, he looked on the Tour Féminin as potentially an agent for real change, social change, and changing attitudes. But there was opposition. When I was researching this, I found a letter that was published in La Provence Cycliste. Said, a woman who runs, a woman who jumps, a woman who swims, that's good. A woman who pedals, that's less pretty. Can you see them arriving completely exhausted at Alpe d'Huez or Avoriaz, all grey from the dust or black from the mud? Will they dare confront in this disfigured state the television cameras without first cleaning up? The feminine ideal could take one hell of a blow.
They've never seen one of my lives, clearly. I've been in worse, far worse states than that. Isn't that so remarkable, though? Do you have more from your...
I've got lots more here, Orla. I mean, the thing was that Marion Martin said they got great support from the roadside. You know, the fans who were there anyway gave them great support. It was just positive. There was no negativity at all. But the media who were covering the men's race showed no interest whatsoever in the women's race. She had that on one of the final days. She was chatting to some of the photographers because she had interest in photography herself. And one of them asked her what she was doing there. And she said, I'm riding the Tour Féminin. He didn't even know it was going on.
But it's not surprising when you listen to the likes of Jacques Anquetil, who will have had huge influence over how the media perceived the race, how fans perceived the race, and saying that he was happy to see women in short white skirts, but not in white shorts. I mean, that's really quite shocking.
Well, Mark Madio, who's still very involved in the sport as the director at FDJ, he at the time said he was in favour of women's cycling, but only if they wore more feminine clothing to bring out their qualities better. He suggested white or pink shorts, sleeveless jerseys or gloves, and socks with a little lace. Laurent Fignon said, I like women, but I prefer to see them doing something else.
Like cooking or ironing, presumably. Yes, well, I can only be glad that times have somewhat changed. Or making energy balls, indeed.
But no, as I say, Felix Levitin was he was very progressive, and he... The mission with the Tour Féminin was much wider than just a women's bike race. He said, for some time now, my wife and I have thought that women do not occupy the position they deserve in society. Woman is equal of man when she is not superior to him. biologically that's proven by the medical schools and scientists. Therefore, we thought about organising something greater than anything that had been done to this point in cycling for athletic women. I went all the way back actually to the 19th century when the bike was invented and cycle racing became a thing. And women showed as much interest in cycle racing back then as men did, and actually as much ability too. And they were actively discouraged from riding and racing. There's a very good book, Cultural History of the Tour de France, which talks about the sort of crisis in French masculinity, which sort of helped to discriminate against women cycling. Christopher Thompson wrote that book, Tour de France, Cultural History, very interesting on all that. But no, I mean, it's a very interesting history, and you do feel that an opportunity was lost in the 80s.
Yeah, and I guess it's no surprise that we're playing such catch-up now. As you say, women were actively discouraged. It was almost seen as subversive for a woman to be riding a bike because it wasn't conducive to the wearing of skirts. And we shouldn't maybe be surprised that we're still fighting a bit of a battle these days to get a bit more equality of coverage, a bit more parity of pay, although that's much better now. And, you know, I think as journalists, we're often asked why more attention isn't given to women cycling, and maybe we can turn it around a little bit and look at it the other way, where a few years ago we were having top class bike races cancelled because they couldn't guarantee rider safety. At least now we're at a stage where we've got a women's world tour, and things have moved on. And when you look back at not that distant the past, to see how things have changed, thank goodness. Amen, sisters.
Well, Marion Martin, who I said I spoke to, she's a very, very unassuming woman. She's still got her tour-winning bike hanging up in her garage, but she doesn't have her yellow jersey on display. And she sort of drifted out of the sport, but, you know, a great early pioneer. And if you want to read a bit more about her, there's a chapter on her in Volume 3 of the Cycling Anthology.
Hello, my name is Charlene Joyner and I ride for Team Ford EcoBoost. You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast in association with the Poppy Scotland Sportif. Three rides over some of the most spectacular roads in Scotland on September the 25th. For more information, see poppyscotland.org.uk.
That was, as she said, Charlene Joyner, Scottish cyclist, former Commonwealth Games medalist, introducing the Poppy Scotland Sportif, which we at the Cycling Podcast are promoting throughout June. It's on the 25th of September, up in Scotland, obviously, in East Lothian. Beautiful, quiet roads, very hilly roads in East Lothian. There's a lot of climbing over the three distances. Go to poppyscotland.org.uk if you're interested in signing up to the Poppy Scotland Sportifs. Now, we've talked a bit about Bulls Dolmans and the Women's World Tour. There's also a very vibrant women's domestic scene in the UK, which has really picked up a lot the last few years with the Women's Tour and also the Matrix Fitness Grand Prix, which runs alongside the Tour Series. And so there's a really exciting scene. Part of that scene this year is Drops Cycling Team, a new team with a very interesting backstory. They're supported by Prendas, the bike shop. Drops is a wallpaper brand, which I didn't know until I went and met with Bob Varney, the team founder, last week. So I caught up with the Drops cycling team in Croydon at the Matrix Fitness Grand Prix held there last week. The day before that, I was in central London to meet one of their riders. It doesn't get much busier or noisier than central London. I'm on Millbank, just opposite MI6 on the other side of the Thames. And at the end of a quiet little street-ish called Ponsonby Terrace. It's an unlikely location, but I'm here to meet one of Britain's top young female cyclists, Abby Van Twisk, who works here in a florist. Hello, Abby. You're Abby?
Yeah.
Are you, Abby? So what are you doing in a flower shop in central London?
I'm just working here because it's my dad's shop, so I work here when I'm not racing to earn some money.
Are you, you're obviously part of the Drops team, part of a really exciting women's scene in the UK. Is it the fact that for, you know, a lot of the women racing at quite a high level that you're working as well?
Yeah. It's not really amongst the pro peloton. Don't think many of them work, but we're not a professional team yet, so just have to do what you can when you're at home.
So tell me how, you know, what's a typical week look like? How many days do you work here? How do you fit in training around that?
So when I'm here for a week, it's normally about 2 to 3 days. And then the days I'm not in here, Then I do my long rides, get the miles in. And when I'm in here, I can do sessions before or after, or both.
So you're training how many days a week?
Usually six, with a rest day. But it depends how many races you've got per week and stuff.
So you're living in London still?
Yeah, living in London.
So where do you train? Where do you do your long rides?
Normally cycle out through London and go Kent Way, Sevenoaks, round there. But it's good when you get out on the country lanes, but it's a bit annoying having to follow the buses out.
Do you train mainly alone, or is there a group of you that go?
Usually alone. There is two of my teammates live nearby, so sometimes I hook up with them, but for long rides it's quite specific to your own training, so usually alone, yeah.
And tell me a bit about the scene that you're part of. Obviously we're in the middle of the tour series just now. We had the Nocturne a couple of days ago, which you rode in. You were 13th in the Nocturne, weren't you?
Yeah.
But tell me what the racing scene is like and where it takes you.
At the moment it's pretty busy because there's three tour series this week amongst like longer road races as well, but it's really fun. Like, I love it. We were going to go to Germany in a few days, but unfortunately we can't now, but we're going to Czech, Brittany, all of those places in the coming weeks, so really excited.
Have you raced much in Europe already this year?
Quite a lot. I mean, at the beginning of the season we did Belgium, then I broke my collarbone, and we've been to France last week, and the team have been to California, so yeah, a bit.
How does it work then? I mean, does the team, it's not, as you say, professional yet, but they cover your expenses, and then it's a case of you having to, you know, work when you can to make some money, I guess.
Yeah, we've got a UCI license, but none of us get paid, so we class ourselves as amateur. And yeah, everything gets paid for by drops when we go away and stuff, but obviously you need some money to live as well.
So it helps have your dad as your employer.
Yeah.
Is that him sitting over there?
Yeah, that is him.
And tell me about how you got into cycling in the first place.
Well, I used to live near Herne Hill Velodrome, and I went down there with my friend, and she hated it, but I loved it.
What age were you then?
Six.
Why did you go down? Was it something you were aware of that you'd seen and just fancied a go?
Yeah, I think, it was my friend's mum. She just heard of it, so we went down on my mountain bike, and then I was too young to actually hire a track bike for the velodrome, but I managed to wangle my way in, got on the track, and yeah.
So it wasn't part of an organised session, was it? Was it just you going rogue?
Well, I think I was a bit young, so I did just go a bit rogue whilst all the older kids were doing it. And then I kind of went down like basically every day for about, I don't know, 4 years when I was younger.
So that was it? You never really looked back?
No, never really looked back.
So can Dad confirm this story? You know, how did you end up with a daughter who's a bike racer?
Well, she's always been absolutely besotted by bikes. She's been riding bikes without stabilisers since she was three. She used to get some very odd looks when she rode through the park on her way to nursery school, whizzing along on her bike. People were just gobsmacked that she could do this. So bike's always been her thing.
And not that you were never a cyclist, no?
Well, I can ride a bike.
No,
no, never a serious cyclist. But, you know, when you've got a daughter that's heavily into it, you sort of establish an interest in it.
Is that a Belgian name or?
No, my father was a Dutchman. I'm half Dutch. He was born in 1900. And came over here shortly before the Second World War.
So there must be cycling in the blood somewhere.
Well, one would like to think so, but I haven't actually found any cyclists in the family line. Abigail could be the first.
Could be the first, but with a name like Van Twisk, I think, you know, it's a sort of cyclist name. So, Abby, tell me, you're going to race, obviously, tomorrow in Croydon. I'm going to come and watch that. This team that has been set up this year does seem to, well, they've got some great riders, but it seems to be a really good setup. Tell me how it came about and how it's organised.
Well, I think the team manager, Bob Varney, was a co-sponsor of last year's team, Corley Drops, and then for this year, well, it all started when we went to the Ardèche, which is a UCI stage race, last September. And then I think Bob just thought to himself, I'm going to do it, I want to do it properly. And so he's literally set this team up from basically nothing, and it's just taken off, and it's amazing.
So what's it like to be part? You've got, you know, we're saying Alice Barnes, who won the Nocturne of the Night, is a teammate. She's clearly already quite a star. There are others in the team. What's it like to be part of a team as opposed to just a club, I suppose?
Oh, it's amazing. Like, it's so, especially our team, well, I don't know about the others, probably the same, but it's so, we get on so well. And even though we may not have the strongest riders within the peloton, I mean, they are very strong, but just being in a team makes you work that extra bit harder, and you have a role to play. So every race, you just sort of have to fulfill that role, and you just, yeah, it just makes you feel stronger as a whole.
Where do your ambitions lie? What sort of races do you want to do well, and where are your strengths at the moment? What sort of races suit you?
I like the longer road races with, like, climbing. So abroad, I like the ones in France with the longer climbs. I do enjoy the Tour Series and stuff, but I wouldn't say it's my forte.
So a Tour Series in Croydon might not be the...
No, not necessarily. Not necessarily, no. Not the, but I do like... Last year it was really, like, technical, and I do like technical. So that should be fun.
So, and long term, what, you know, you're 19 now, is that right? Yeah. What do you see in your future? Do you want to be a full-time professional cyclist? Is that what you're focused on?
That's the dream, yeah. I'm going to see where it takes me with drops. See, just sort of develop in the really big races and see where it can take me, yeah.
Well, your dad seems to think that you've got an exciting future. I hope he's not working you too hard.
I know. He should give me a bit of time off.
Paid leave.
Yeah.
He's shaking his head at that. Great. Well, listen, I'll come and see you tomorrow night in Croydon, and we'll see how that goes. Who's going to win tomorrow night? Alice again or somebody else?
Alice.
As I arrived in Croydon for the Matrix Fitness Grand Prix, which ran alongside the Men's Tour Series, I met Bob Varney, the founder and team director at the Drops cycling team. So Bob Varney, we're in glamorous Croydon, but this has been quite a first season for the team, hasn't it? You were telling me a moment or so ago about your first continental outing in Belgium earlier this year.
Yeah, GP Samyon on the 2nd of March. That was our first race, UCI 1.1, I think. Parachuting into a war zone, I think one of our critics said. So we use that very much as a motivational tool. And I think Jen George over there, she always says that if you're going to parachute into a war zone, go with your best fighters. And that's kind of what we did. So, yeah, we have come a long way. And Jen was 4 minutes down on Lizzie at Flanders after 141Ks, 10 cobbled climbs. We were there for 2 weeks, you know, well, nearly 2 weeks, 10 days. We did three classics. So we've really been mixing it with the best.
So what was the catalyst for this team then? What was the... I know you've been involved for several years, but what was the thing that made you think, right, we're going to take it up a level and establish this as a team in its own right and go and take on these races?
Well, historically, I used to run a youth development programme in Milton Keynes. We had 151 kids, and we had a racing team from that. And we had a bit of a blueprint where we took the kids abroad racing and Ireland and various places. And from that, we had three or four British internationals, Adam Illingworth, James Flanagan, and Ian Stannard, the Sky Pro. So we had a bit of history to that. Then I left the sport for about 10 years and went and did other stuff. I was asked to co-sponsor a local team last year, which I needed a bit of persuasion to do, but then I ended up doing it. And by a lot of different quirks of fate, I was asked to look after their women's team in May last year. And I went along slightly reluctantly, and the rest is history. So we were co-sponsors last year, and this year we thought we'd have a go, and see if we could up the stakes a bit.
Well, it's a huge commitment you're making to, you know, the program is pretty intense. And having been involved in the sport a few years ago, I guess has this taken you by surprise a little bit, just how packed the women's calendar is?
Well, I accept entirely that things have escalated somewhat. I do have natural enthusiasm for life. And my father died last year. I guess he was part of the catalyst. I was very close to him. He was 87. And I'd always promised myself a bit of an adventure this year. So I've kind of turned this into the adventure, as it were. It was meant to be a year out, but I'm actually ended up working like four times as hard as I ever used to. But yeah, so I guess that was the catalyst. We have got carried away a little bit with it, but in a nice way. And yeah, if you do anything in life, you should do it to your very best. And opportunities arose. And we were invited to go to the Tour of California. So what did you say, no?
Presumably for this team to have a future and be sustainable, you'd be looking for what, sponsorship or what's the plan?
Yeah, it will always have a future. We've already decided that we're all loving it so much. And my son is very much an active part of it. I call him hashtag the quiet one because I'm a bit larger than life. And, you know, he sits away working away behind the scenes. So we've already agreed that we're already working on proposals for next year. We're already talking to big sponsors. So we're very ambitious and we want to build on this. We've had an amazing start and we really want to go professional next year. That's our plan. We're proudly amateur because we think there's a lot of hypocrisy in sport where people are saying they're professional and they're not really professional. So there's no disrespect to them, but we just want to live our life how we feel is the right way. So we're amateur. The girls don't get paid. But, you know, we stay in lovely hotels and they have the best equipment and they're all really cool with that. And we're very honest and transparent about that. But to step up, we want to go pro next year and pay everyone a living wage. Now, that is actually quite a commitment. You know, 16, possibly 16 riders, you know, 4, 5, 6 staff. It doesn't come cheap. So we're talking to the right people about that. And we've got 3 or 4 quite good leads. So we're hoping that we can genuinely step up next year.
Well, I wish you the best of luck for tonight. You're on fire at the moment. Alice Barnes has won 2 out of the last 3 nights, I think it is. Is she going to make it 3 in a row tonight?
It's going to be very difficult today. Alice is going to be marked super tight. It's a very technical course that she can excel on without a shadow of doubt. Our objectives tonight are to have 2 in the top 5 and 1, the third rider in the top 10. And we'll be happy with that.
Right, well, I'll catch up with you again at the end. Alice Barnes has been the star of the Drops team in recent weeks. She's the sister of Hannah, who rides for Canyon SRAM, and she put in another strong performance in Croydon, but unfortunately it ended her winning streak. She was second on the night to Grace Garner. Immediately afterwards, I spoke with Alice about her plans for the rest of the season.
Alice, you've been absolutely on fire winning your last 2 races. Your winning run has come to an end tonight. Is that, you're very, very close, but is that slightly disappointing or was it just inevitable?
Yeah, obviously I'd have liked to win again, but the last 2 races I've done, I've won quite hard ways and pretty tired coming into today, so I'm quite happy with second on with bad legs today. It's just taken a bit of a toll, so I'm looking forward to a bit of a rest day tomorrow.
I mean, you must be delighted because you're racing against women much older than you. You know, it's a big step up. And is this the sort of racing that you most enjoy? Because you're obviously very versatile. You do lots of different disciplines. Is crit racing something that you find that you're really good at?
Yeah, crit racing, I do really enjoy. I enjoy the technical side and it's always a great atmosphere, so it's good and exciting racing. But I also love the long road races as well. So I start the Women's Tour of Britain next week, so I'm not doing the last round in Portsmouth on Thursday to focus on looking at some of the stages for the Women's Tour of Britain. So it's great to get some wins in the last couple of days, but they're just sort of stepping stones for the way forward.
So Abby, it's a long way from the Forest and central London to a car park in Croydon, and the race just finished. How did you get on?
I did all right. I mean, we were working to get 3 drops in the top 10 to maintain our lead, and yeah, me and Lucy just got distance towards the second half of the race, but yeah, we did some work in the first half and we finished, I think we were about 12th and 15th or something.
And Alice was second, so she, you know, just missed out on keeping that record of hers going. And it was an impressive team performance. You guys were on the front, at least 1 or 2. You were on the front most of the race, it seemed.
Yeah, Alice did really well again. We can always rely on her to get top 3. And yeah, I think we just tried to make it an attacking race, so it's good for the spectators and also a hard race. So quality's left at the end.
Pretty much as you predicted there.
Well, I thought we were a bit off. I think we wanted 2 in the top 5 and the third one in the top 11 and 10. And I think we had 2 in the top 6.
And not far off.
And 11th. So, but they'll be gutted because they didn't do what they wanted to do. I can tell by their mood. They can't wait to have a debrief. We always have a debrief, good or bad. So it's good. It's the way we learn and get better. It was a hard race though, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, I was saying to Abby there that it was certainly impressive to see how the team were trying to ride. You always had a couple of riders in the top three, four, five, you know, monitoring things, and you seemed very, very present at the front where a lot of teams weren't.
Yeah, I mean, we're very visible in the kit and the helmets. But yeah, that's always the plan. Yeah, be at the front, trying to make the race. That's our strategy. We go abroad and we try to learn and come back and kind of put that into practice. So you can see the way that the girls' confidence has grown. And we didn't need to win today. I know we all want to win, but we didn't need to win today. You know, we won emphatically yesterday, so.
You said earlier, you know, it's an amateur team, but you clearly try and do things very professionally. The way that the chairs are laid out, you know, you got the van and the girls on rollers, they're warming down. You're trying to do things very professionally. You mentioned the debrief as well.
Yeah, yeah. We aspire to be the most professional women's amateur team in the world. That we come up to that probably on a bar stool, I'd imagine, at the end of last year. But we're sticking true to that. And then anything we do, that's what we go back to. That's where we anchor. That's what we want to do. So if there's a right way of doing something and a wrong way, we try and do it the right way.
It's better than being the most amateur professional team. There's a few contenders for that.
Yeah, I couldn't possibly comment.
In Croydon, I also met Guy Elliott, who works for Sweet Spot, the organisers of Tour Series, Women's Tour and Tour Britain. Many have described Guy as the brains behind the women's tour, even if he is reluctant to take all the credit himself. Guy Elliott, we're at the Tour Series in Croydon. You're credited as one of the driving forces behind the women's tour, which is now a well-established, very popular, some might say the best women's stage race on the world calendar. But can you just tell me about the origins of it? How did it come about?
Yeah, well, Sweet Spot have been running the Tour of Britain for about 10 years, something like that. And then we looked at women's sport and realised that there was terrible discrimination against women. Races on the continent really didn't recognise the quality of the women's peloton that's come along. And I honestly don't know whose idea it was. I get credited with the idea, but it wasn't. I don't think it was my idea. It was a meeting of minds. And I joined Sweet Spot to help create the women's tour. So I'm the front man, if you like. And we decided to set up a race that was equivalent as we could possibly get with the Men's Tour of Britain. So that's how it came about. But I just like to say I get the credit. I'm one of a number of people working on it.
That first event was tremendously popular. You know, it was unknown. Don't think people knew how many crowds there would be. The quality of the field was very high, but the crowds were enormous. But in that period of setting up and attracting sponsorship and support and the backing of important people, did you come up against any barriers, challenges that you had to sort of overcome?
Yeah, we came up against sexism, blatant discrimination, where people would close the door and say, we're not interested in this, nobody's interested in women's sport, nobody will watch. And from some big companies with big diversity agendas. So that was quite interesting. So the men that worked on the women's tour found out what it was like to hit the glass ceiling.
Well, was that quite blatant? Was it stated as explicitly as that?
Yes. Yeah.
So how did you overcome that? I mean, was it just a case of keeping banging on more doors until you found one that opened, or what happened?
We model the commercial. We try and run the commercial model like the Men's Tour of Britain, where you ideally have a headline sponsor and then you have councils or county councils contributing to a stage and then commercial sponsors. So we're not dependent on any of those single layers, if you like. And where we got a receptive response is when we went to county councils and explained, or they knew it already, but highlighted what was happening to young girls in physical education and sport and participation, and then told them about discrimination against female athletes like Laura Trott, where apart from the Olympics, you know, nothing much happens, except perhaps on the track, and that they weren't being treated properly. And then we got an overwhelmingly positive response. And the first one, we were nervous, we were scared, because we were hyping the event. And the first one was Northamptonshire. So Councillor Heather Smith turned round, and we were after just a stage town, a start or a finish. And Northamptonshire said, we'll take a whole stage, and it rolled from there, really.
So you say it never gets easy in terms of attracting the backing and support, but would you say the event's established enough? I know you're going to lose a headline sponsor as well after this year. Are you confident that the event is established enough now that it's got a good and long future?
Totally and absolutely confident. We'd like a headline sponsor. We're working on that. But we don't want to undersell ourselves. We think we've got a good product. We would never turn sponsors away. So we have some, Strava. It's been very good with Strava, the Queen of the Mountains. And we've got good support from Skoda, people like that, and Chain Reaction and Yodel. But a headline sponsor is the icing on the cake. And one thing we'd like to do is move to live TV. That's really expensive. So, for example, if we weren't to get a headline, that's the sort of thing where we want to invest test for the future. But we're absolutely confident that the commercial model we've got and the councils that want us, we're absolutely fixed for the future. No problem.
There is talk of the race expanding to 7 days. Can you tell me what might happen in that regard?
Oh, well, yes, we have to submit our plans every May or June to British Cycling and the UCI for the following year. It's a quite a long time in advance. It's a year in advance, and we've asked for 7 days. We would have liked to have moved to 6 days, I think, last year, but the UCI and British Cycling normally like to have a look at a new event to make sure it's sustainable, good quality. But I don't think anyone could say, you know, we haven't delivered. So we've put our application in for 7 days, and we're assuming, you know, we're hoping they'll approve it, and can't see why they wouldn't. So we're very excited about the following year, because that means we'll be able to take it to some even more interesting areas.
To Scotland, perhaps?
People ask about that. I think that's a bit ambitious at the moment because of travel time. But I think we could go to more height. We're going to look at the route this year where we're going to the Peak District. Perhaps we will go up into a Welsh mountain, you know, some proper Welsh mountain, something like that.
The cycling podcast Femina. Interviews, insight and analysis of women's racing. Supported by Rowan King's Cycling Coaching. Tailored training plans by Danny King and Luke Rowe. For more information, go to rowanking.com.
So I must say, Orla, I really enjoyed meeting the Drops team. There was a real honesty about them. As Bob Varney said, they don't claim to be professional when they're not, but they race and act in a very professional way. It's an interesting team with a real spectrum of ages. You know, they've got some really young riders like Abby Van Twisk, who we heard from, and Alice Barnes, who are both 19, but also some very experienced riders as well. And I think they're doing a great thing. And, you know, Bob's enthusiasm for it comes across. They've got some great backers. I mentioned Prendas. And the whole thing feels very authentic and very something that could really develop. And I was very impressed with how they raced in Croydon as well. They had a plan, and you could see them executing that plan. And I was, you know, I'd say very impressed by them.
There's something very refreshing about them as well, and their attitude and their evident love of cycling, of racing, and doing it for the win and the sheer joy, hoping obviously to turn professional. And there's something about them being on the cusp of, I guess, every youngster's dream of turning professional. And it's lovely to be on that journey with them, I guess, and watching that and seeing if they can make it. I mean, most of their riders are still at school. You spoke to Abby and she's clearly working, but it's that lovely age mixture as well. So you've got Laura Massey, 34, who's the current British Masters champion, who's on a sabbatical from her job in the pharmaceutical industry. So it's a lovely mixture, I think, and it's about keeping that dream alive. And I don't mean that in a patronising way, because they are being very professional and they are hoping, you know, to turn professional. And I wanted to mention as well just a little bit about Abby Van Twisk, and I think this is important as a female reporting on.
I don't think it is important. You mentioned this earlier.
I've just got to salute her style. I was doing some research on her, and she said her favourite Christmas present was a sick, in inverted commas, she's young, she can get away with that, sick silver puffer jacket. And I thought, she's my kind of gal. I'm trying to rock a bit of a gold lamé bomber jacket at the minute, which I think could go quite well with her. So maybe we could have a night out in the town, Abby, if you fancy.
She's a bit young for your world.
I'd bring experience to the party, though. I've got plenty of that.
Young at heart.
Indeed,
young at heart.
Indeed.
No, but it's a good time to introduce our first Peddlers de Charme as well, because I'm off the women's tour this week, so I can present it to... Who's our first Peddlers de Charme?
Our first Peddlers de Charme is none other than Alice Barnes, the under 23 British champion. Her preferred discipline of cross-country mountain bike is not going to feature for her at the Olympics because Britain didn't qualify a team. So she has an outside chance, maybe we would say outside, of qualifying for the third spot at the Olympic Games. But she's had a fantastic season, two straight wins on home soil, and she'll be competing on what will be home turf, really, at the women's tour. Her parents just moved to Kettering, which is where the race finishes off at the end of stage five, and her sister won the final stage last year, so they'll be hoping for a bit of a family celebration.
Her sister Hannah, who featured in a podcast we did earlier this year, Survivors of Spring, number 4 in our Kilometre Zero for Survivors of Spring. I spent a day with Canyon SRAM at Flesh Wallonne, and it was Hannah's second race back after a terrible injury where she smashed up her ankle in America last year and spent 5 months on crutches. So understandably, she's returning sort of gingerly, but getting stronger all the time. I'm sure we'll see her winning again very soon. What else have we got to talk about today, Orla?
Well, I just wanted to mention very quickly what Guy Elliott spoke about, actually saying that almost dreaded word and tying his colours to the mast, saying that, yep, he has encountered sexism in cycling. And the reason I want to bring it up is because it's such a difficult topic to talk about, and whatever you say is wrong. We saw it with the whole Shane Sutton story. Whichever side you took, I guess, was wrong, and you've got to completely follow the PC line. So as a woman, if I say there is sexism in cycling, men can disagree, but also women might disagree and say, well, you're not doing any favours for any of us by saying that. We've just got to work on, we've got to plow on, we've got to work at least as hard, if not harder than the men. And that's fine. But sometimes you've just got to acknowledge if there's a problem, you've got to acknowledge that it's an issue, and then you can address it. I mean, he's done incredible work, and Sweet Spot have done incredible work in terms of building that race. It's almost like the Kevin Costner film, Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. They've built the race. The media are now coming. The sponsorship money is now coming. But it's taken someone to say, yep, we have faced sexism in the sport, to actually get it to that level. And there is still sexism in the sport, and there are still people who would rather see women wearing short white skirts rather than cycling shorts. That's not necessarily going to change, but I applaud him for having his opinion on that, that's based on experience, and for being so black and white about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think What's impressive about Guy Elliott and Sweet Spot is they've just gone out and done it. Mm. And yeah, I was quite taken aback by the sort of explicitness of his response to that question. I was momentarily dumbfounded.
Doesn't happen often.
Didn't really know what to say, because to hear that, you know, companies had rejected their proposal on the basis simply and entirely of it being a women's event was quite surprising to hear. It maybe shouldn't be surprising, because anybody can acknowledge that sexism in cycling is a reality. But, you know, the way to combat that is to do something positive about it rather than to whinge about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that's a problem with anybody saying that there's sexism in cycling or in any sport, because you're seen as a whinger.
Stop whinging, Orla.
You women, you're all the same. But I think that you shouldn't be prevented from acknowledging the problem and doing something. They're not mutually exclusive. And Guy Elliott is a case in point. He's someone who's saying, yep, this is what we've experienced. This is the situation in cycling. But you know what? We're getting on and we're doing something about it. And that's clearly the way to do it. But I think too much political correctness is never a good thing. And that's maybe what we've got sometimes in women's cycling or in women's sport in general.
PC,
but I'll get off my high horse now. That's dismount.
Climb back down. Yes. And I think we'll be rationing your intake of energy balls for the next Cycling Podcast Femina. Are we looking forward to the women's tour? Something I should mention about the women's tour. I mentioned that I'd spoken to Lizzie Armistead as well recently, and that she took May off. Now, I was speaking to her before she took May off, and she came back and she's won her first race back at the Bulls Rental Hills Classic recently. So she's obviously still in very good form, but I don't think she was very sure what form she would come back in. And, you know, this is her home tour, and there's a lot of expectation, pressure, if you like, for her to perform well. But she was really prepared and willing to sacrifice this race. If she doesn't have the form, she's not going to... This is, in the context of Olympic year, really unimportant. And it takes guts to take that approach, you know, because as world champion, as the best known female rider in Britain, people will be expecting her to be at the front. And I think she maybe will win the race, but she's certainly open to not performing that well. She'll also go to the Giro Rosa in Italy, and she does not expect to perform well there. She's going to try and be up there, said, on one hilly stage, but on other days she could be finishing 10 minutes down. And, you know, that does take some guts to just do your own thing and focus on that bigger picture.
It does, but it also shows where she is at in her career and her growth as an athlete. And I also think that because of her stature and her profile, simply being at the women's tour will almost be enough. It's almost like a Mark Cavendish or Bradley Wiggins riding the tour of Britain. You want to see them there. You want the pictures on television and in the newspapers, and you want to see her at the start line. I think we've got a fairly educated cycling fan base in this country now, whereby people will understand that she's going for the Olympic Games, and that's the most important thing. But as long as she is there, then that's a huge boost to the race. I say a huge boost, like it needs it. It's got the strongest lineup ever, and I think it's going to be incredibly exciting. We've got Marianne Vos after her 2 years of injury. We've got Emma Pooley once again after her 2 years of retirement and a not so successful tour to Yorkshire. We have Emma Johansson, who we heard from. You know, we've got a great lineup, and I think it's going to be really exciting. And I don't think it's going to matter that much if Lizzie doesn't go hell for leather. It'd be great if she could. But if she doesn't, I think the fact that she's there, and like I say, she's got that stature, she's almost stateswoman-like, if that's a word.
And very interested to see how Vos goes, because she's been getting stronger and stronger, and she's been named in the Dutch team for the Olympic Games. You know, Chantal Black has missed out on that, which shows you how strong a team they have. The Americans also have a very strong team for the Olympic Games, which will be a factor, I'm sure, on such a tough course. But Vos, yeah, very curious to see how she gets on, because... certainly a month or so ago, people were talking down her chances, not thinking that she would return to her previous level, at least not this year. But she seems to be getting reasonably close.
And by the time the women's tour starts, we won't necessarily know, but the British riders will know if they've been selected for the Olympic Games. So all of that will be playing on their minds as well, including Marianne Vos's, because she is the defending Olympic champion. She'll want to bring that home. So I think this will be possibly a bit of a testing ground for her and continue with that form building towards August. But it'll be good fun to watch.
Well, we better wrap it up, Orla. I think we've gone on long enough. But we'll be back next month. We'll look back on the women's tour and maybe at the Giro Rosa as well, depending on when the episode comes out. The one after that, we'll be looking ahead to the Olympic Games. And we've got an interview for that one with Becky James. Very interesting interview, because she has got a fascinating story as well. So we'll be out with the second Cycling Podcast Femina next month, and then the third one in very early August.
Very exciting times ahead. I can't wait for this summer's racing with women's cycling. You mentioned the races coming up, and I think that the Women's Olympic road race is going to be an absolute stonker. Can't wait to the build up to that.
Okay, before we go, I'm just going to say a few thank yous. Thank you, obviously, to our sponsors, Roe and King Coaching. Thanks to Bowles Dolmans and Drops for their help with those two features. Thanks to Owen Rogers. Thanks to Hannah Troop. Thanks to Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb. Thank you to Jonathan Rowe, who produced this episode and has been very involved in getting this Cycling Podcast Femina off the ground. Thanks to Rob Hatch, whose voice you might have recognised in our jingles here. And thanks also to Paul Shafto and to Steve Fry. And that's all. So thank you very much, Orla.
Thanks to you, Richard.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast Femina. For more information and to download more episodes, go to thecyclingpodcast.com.